2012 meeting for Devil's Lake Water Improvement District. Put forward the consent agenda approval. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimous. Comment? Mr. Brown?
Do you want me on one mic or the other to make any difference here or not?
No, it doesn't make any difference.
My name is Larry Brown. I reside at 35 Indian Shores here in Lincoln City. I also have a home in Salem. Recording my time down. One of the mics?
Yeah, one or the other.
Yeah, okay.
And they're really directional, so you have to speak right into them.
Okay.
Thanks.
Everybody hear me okay now? Okay. At our last meeting, I talked a little bit about the cafe and your existing lease with the Radio Shack people, Bruce Pulvey. And in that conversation, I suggested to you that I thought you were missing the boat with regard to at least one issue that I've talked with a little bit with Randy, a little bit with Noel, and that's the tax-exempt status that you're not taking advantage of with regard to a special district, which you are here. So I talked to Bruce, and I said, Bruce, I said, you know, these folks are occupying a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of real estate that you're leasing to them for a couple thousand dollars a month, and it seems to me that they would be eligible for clearly eligible for tax exemption. And if you were to save $500 a month, I'm assuming you'd pass that directly on to them. My conversation with him, that he said, clearly, Larry, whatever I could save, if I can save in real property taxes, I would pass that on to the board. So I checked with the Archives Division where the filings were and things like that to see where the original filings were made when the special district was created basically 20 years ago. There aren't any problems from that end. I got a hold of Rob Thomas, who's the Lincoln County tax assessor, and I've talked to a lot of tax assessors in my business over the years. He's extremely knowledgeable in this area. He took a look at the Water Improvement District and said, hey, clearly in my mind, they're just like any municipal corporation. They're clearly eligible for a tax exemption. They're taxpayer funded. They're not state operated or owned. And as a result, clearly it seems to me you can file for an exemption. And if we're going to do that, after you do your research that can follow mine here, I think you want to file for this exemption, and it's timely to do it now. It has to be done after the first of the year, which we're after the first year, and it has to be completed prior to March 31st. I looked up the Oregon applicable statutes with regard to it. Your lease would have to be amended and modified to spell out clearly that the benefits that would accrue to Bruce Pulvey would be passed directly on to you. So the tax assessor is not going to give you a tax break and then, or give him a tax break and not have it passed on to you. In other words, the beneficiary is yourself. You're the ones entitled to it, not the Radio Shack people. So I made some copies of this statute, one of which I'll give to Paul to the extent that it explains how things need to be put together. I would suggest that a board member or your manager or somebody then sit down with Rob Thomas down in Newport, or you can do it on the phone if you want, but it seems to me I like to have a personal contact with somebody. He can spell out for you, and he will tell you exactly what forms and things need to be filled out. And things need to be done in an orderly manner, and this statute needs to be followed in the process. It's nothing complicated, nothing that can't be done in a matter of a couple of days, but I certainly think it's something that you want to look into in depth. You want to do it at this particular point in time. We're really good at spending money around here, and as you well know, across the country, there's lots of agencies that are great at spending money but not too good at saving them. So I think from a taxpayer's perspective, for myself and for all the other people here in Lincoln County that pay assessments for this type of thing, we look forward to you guys saving some money.
Thank you.
So I'll leave these with Paul, and Paul can disseminate these out to whatever board member is here in this particular Oregon statute. You can take a look at it and kind of go from here.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional public comment tonight? Okay. So, moving on to unfinished business, Devil's Lake Plan. It's like septic tank revitalization program. So
as far as the septic tank revitalization program goes, what we've been up to the last month is just kind of assisting the city. They've asked us to do a couple of things to help them in the creation of the ordinance, which they're currently drafting. And then other questions that they've had. So just, you know, we basically prepared a memo. They had asked us to put together other municipalities, states, or counties that have had mandatory inspections on septic systems. So I just looked up a few, one in Arizona, Washington, the state of Wisconsin, and then also looked at Queensland's county in Maryland, and then a municipality in California that had done one of those. And it's interesting because when you look at how these all started, it's basically the exact same thing that we're doing. They were looking at a public water body, and they're looking at protecting the public water body for the health and safety and welfare for the people who are living there. So I think we're pretty much on track for the reasons that we're doing this are the same reasons that you're seeing all over the country. And then a second thing that they had asked us to do is just to look up inspection criteria, just when we get to that point of what do we actually want to inspect in septic systems. And those having a very standard form is important. So I talked with Environmental Management Services, and they're a septic installer in Oregon and Washington. And the guy's name is Bob Sweeney, and he's really on it, really an expert in the field. And they have this really extensive inspection form that I think we can start to use that as a base as we move forward. And then the final thing is we wanted to do an update to our septic database that we have. So we requested from the county just basically any, when we got done with our databases of January 2010, I think. So we just asked for any files that have been updated since then, and we just got that back yesterday, and I haven't really had a chance to look at it, but it looks like there's about 15 systems that went through a county permitting process. So for the next meeting, I'll come back to you about the nature of those systems and what happened and just kind of give you an update. And then I'll also go down to the Newport office to make sure our database is up to date.
So are you looking at some of these, the inspection criteria from some of these other municipalities and what they're doing, or are you just...
Yeah, I looked through, for a lot of them, it's just not what, for the state of Washington, for example, and the state of Wisconsin, they just have a statewide inspection program. So they just require that the counties have a program that they're inspecting septics, but when you start going to the counties, they can do it however they want. So for example, you know, I looked at, like, my home county, like, in Wisconsin, and there's really easy. It's just someone goes and looks, and it's just not a very formal evaluation. Then if you go to, like, other counties, it's, like, a really extensive form.
So are you pulling together a few examples?
Yeah, definitely. We have further ones. But I think that one, the one I was talking about is just really comprehensive, and I think from there you can just start to eliminate things if we don't feel like we need those to be inspected.
Are you planning on working with Tony down at the county sanitarium?
Yeah, we stay pretty close in touch with them and have been in touch with them asking for, like, the database update also.
Okay. Thanks. Additional questions for Seth?
Not I.
Save our shorelines.
So I have two items for that. One is an additional piece of paper that I gave you, and I'll start off of just the staff report that was published. And this is regarding the Northwest Oregon Restoration Partnership that we talked about a couple times in past meetings. The partnership it consists of watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, state agencies, land conservancies, and basically just other groups that are doing restorations with native plants in Northwest Oregon. So they have this restoration partnership. Basic premise of it is the groups go out, they collect seed and other plant materials that they want, they bring it back into the partnership propagates those, keeps them for a year till they can put them in about gallon-sized pots, they're ready to plant, and then send them back out to the partners, and they plant them, and it's all free, like all the plant and everything is free, so it's a really great partnership program. So at the last meeting, I'd suggested that we join that partnership program. I just put that on the got on the agenda late. So now I think everyone's had a chance to read that agreement, and we can decide if we want to join the Restoration Partnership, which is then different than what I'll present next.
Did you guys get a chance to read the Restoration Partnership that Seth had sent out earlier? Basically for participating in the plans and...
Yeah, this is the one that went out.
Mid-December.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to talk more about that tonight, I thought.
Yeah, the second one, the second thing that I give you, that's where we actually are asked to contribute. As far as like the Northwest Partnership, Restoration Partnership goes, that really is just at any level that we want to participate in that program. So, I mean, we could sign it and never do anything with it also.
So,
yeah, I thought we already decided to join that program, did we not?
No, we were going to decide.
Okay.
So I'll make a motion. Join the program?
Second.
Discussion?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Carried unanimously. Okay, so now that we're going to join the program.
There we go. Will Paul have the right to sign that? Is that
expansion piece, right?
Yes, then the second part. So part of that program, how we were kind of invited to participate in it is that they were extending their boundaries of it a little bit more. So now, like Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council, Lincoln Soil and Water Conservation District have also been looking at that program. I think our role will be a little bit more reserved than theirs. So, for example, the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council is really gung-ho about being a big participant in this program. So they have main nurseries, but then there's also satellite nurseries. And the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council wants to create one of these satellite nurseries. So in the last really like week, this has all gone really quickly, and they're working with Taft High School to host the nursery at Taft High School. And then Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council would manage that nursery. So as part of managing it, the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council is going to write a National Fish and Wildlife Grant that can get them somebody who can be responsible for that. And they won't just be responsible for the nursery, but it's an educational grant. So that person will manage the nursery, work with high school students to do the maintenance, but then also just be involved in the community, talking about the benefits of native plants, of restorations, shoreline restorations, really a lot of like what Save Our Shoreline does, which would be a benefit to us. So as part of that grant, they're looking now for partners, and they've requested one that we offer a letter of support for that project, which I think we should do for sure. And then they've also asked as part of the a grant, they require a match. So they've just asked the district if we'd be interested in providing some of that match, and they've asked that we provide that in the form of time, which can be staff time, it can be volunteer time. So I've just listed here on the sheet what could be counted as time for the grant. So like any time we do a project consultation or any planning, that would be considered time. When we do public outreach, that's considered time. The educational courses that we've held, we did like a lakescaping for landscapers and a lakescaping for homeowners, that would be considered time that could be used. If we go and do seed harvesting, restorations, if any direct work of the nursery, then again like those homeowner consultations would all be considered match. So the one, as I said, this has come together kind of quickly for them, and the exact amount that they would want from us isn't completely set, but they have an estimate of asking for about 10 hours a month over the lifetime of the grant, which is an 18 months that they're asking for it. So it'd basically just be us providing 180 hours of staff time to participate in the nursery and public education. So when I reviewed it at the current staffing levels that we have, it's pretty minimal, since for the most part, as part of the Save Our Shoreline program, we're doing all of these things, and we're definitely doing them at over 180 hours over an 18-month period. But the one thing to consider then is just staffing levels in the future that we have. And the current level that we have, it's only assured through July 1, 2011. So it may be wise not to commit to the full 180 hours. And then the other thing, just there are a lot of benefits to this program. And one of them is just, you know, that it's free plants. If they do have the plants, we can get these plants for free, or we can get them at a very discounted price. As part of the Northwest Partnership, if we just sign, now that we're signing into that, the one problem that we have with that is that their plant delivery is only once or twice a year, and that's not really conducive with the nature of the Save Our Shoreline program, because ours kind of goes on when we can actually meet with the property owner and when we can do the planting. So the benefit of working with them and having a local nursery is that, one, we could maybe store plants there so that they could do that. You know, we know what we need over the year. We'd get that delivery. We could store it there. Or the plants would be propagated there so we could get access to them. And then finally, just the possibility of having a local nursery. A lot of the plants that the Northwest Partnership does, we wouldn't use. Like, they're just bigger species, and they're not set up for, like, the small-scale restorations that we do. So it'd potentially be the opportunity for us to have more control over what's being grown and things that are more grown for us. Again, this is early on, so I don't want to make promises and say we're never going to pay for plants anymore, or we're going to have all the plants that we need or anything like that. It's really not 100% known. So then finally, I just suggest that we, regardless of anything we decide, definitely write a letter of support, because this program and our program are really tied together with the same goals. And then, you know, I'd make a couple suggestions, offering the 180 hours of staff time, which was that based on the 10 hours per month, going to a limited level, which was saying 10 hours while we have the current staffing levels, and using an intern through the summer, which I imagine that we'll have. And then if we then take 5 hours after that for the remaining 12 months, you'd be looking at 110 hours, which I think is pretty reasonable. And then if you guys think something else, if you guys want to go with something smaller, that's at the pleasure of the board. And then the final thing was just, tomorrow is when they're having the meeting with the other partners, so really knowing the total match that they want yet, they're not 100% certain. So it could be that we approve 180 and it turns out they don't need all that time and we could bring it back at that point. So sorry, that's kind of a long explanation. Anyone have any questions?
Questions for Paul, maybe. You know, I don't know what our plans are, because we haven't started laying out our staffing models and our budget for next year. But I would assume that we're still planning on having interns in the summers.
You know, and that's part of the discussion we haven't had. But I would assume I'm assuming that we're going to look into that too. So yes, I mean, that is your decision though.
Historically, would our summer intern have the bandwidth to participate in, you know, upkeeping Save Our Shoreline type activities?
Yeah, you know, we've pretty much set up our internships kind of based on the water quality work that is done, and then, frankly, taking whatever skill sets also coming with that intern and, you know, manipulating the internship a little bit around their skill sets on occasion. But, yeah, you know, the last one, you know, was working on outreach more, you know. This could be outreach for plants, which would qualify. It could just be physical, you know, on-the-ground stuff, which would obviously qualify. So, yeah, I think there's a real opportunity to fill that 180 hours with, you know, staff, with volunteers, with interns, lots of opportunities. Like, if we had just all the people, you know, sitting here go out for 2 hours, you know, we'd have quite a few hours. So, I think, you know, personally, I think that this 180 hours is a bar we could hit pretty easily, you know, especially considering we've got Seth right now through the end of July or end of June for sure. And if the board, you know, wants to look at other opportunities and that exists with him as well, then, you know, there's those too. So, I think within and the key is, and I think was what Seth was alluding to, is these are things that we're already doing. So it's like we're just kind of giving credit to this other program so they can get credit for it, so they can get this match. So it's really just a win-win. They just get to acknowledge, or the granting entity that potentially gives them the grant acknowledges that, you know, they have money that or work that's being done in the watershed of similar value, and so that applies to their grant. And that's the goal, is so that they can attract the money and they can get the funding and they can build this program. Because this whole idea of having a full nursery and education component, I think it's just fabulous. And Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council's to be credited for spearheading this and really pushing this forward, because it really is their project. And you know, they've got some good board members too and great staff. So, you know, I think it'll put it together.
So I guess my last question to you is, you know, kind of out of, you know, if I assume that we're intern and lake manager only moving forward, mm-hmm. after, you know, next year, which I don't know where we're going to land, but mm-hmm. let's assume the worst, right?
Sure.
Maybe we have you and an intern for the summer, for you meeting the commitments in the you know, in the off season. We don't have an intern to you to take some of these commitments. Are those things that you're already doing that would qualify for that? Or what would it take away from things that you need to do?
I would have to say that I'm not as actively involved in... Seth is obviously the primary on all this SOS stuff, and I'm just kind of ancillary. So I would plug in maybe a 10% onto what he's doing, you know, which we'd get credit for. But, you know, as far as, like, new stuff, I mean, it would be additional, for sure.
Additional.
Yeah, it would be additional, yeah. But I think the key is to look at maybe with this is versus maybe instead of saying a 10-hour per month commitment, just putting a 180-hour commitment. And then you can get, if you had a work party, say, end of October, which, you know, I could organize, you know, even just without the intern, whatever. That's going to really be a number of hours that are going to accumulate quite rapidly.
And then the Save Our Shoreline restoration would easily push us into 20 hours or more. That would qualify, right?
Any restoration, you bet. Yeah, yeah.
Can you approximate how much time you spend a month right now on Save Our Shoreline?
It varies by month, but yeah, when I like do my timesheets, I break it down by project that I'm working on.
Can you just give us your best ballpark?
I'd have to say it's probably like a third. I would expect. I mean, depending on the season.
Okay, so that's like 50 hours a month.
Right.
And most of that could be used as a credit to this anyway.
Right.
Yeah, all of it, basically. We don't have it promised to any other kind of grant, so it's like we're doing this work anyhow, so we can show this other granting agency, you know, that this work's being done to get credit for it. You know, we couldn't do that two or three times to different applications, but we only have this one that we're offering potentially a match to, if that makes sense.
So, I mean, you know, just doing the math, I mean, if most of your time could be credited, say, 30 hours a month, mm-hmm. or 18 months is 540 hours, and I don't see a problem with a 180-hour commitment.
Okay. I have a question.
That bar is non-existent. I mean,
yeah.
Step over that.
I do have a question. Would you go back over how we can make use of this nursery? I mean, you said something about only twice a year they would be able to deliver plants.
So the first part, like the Northwest Oregon Restoration Partnership Agreement, which was like the first part of the staff report, that is, they basically just do, you know, they have everything at like a main nursery or these other satellite nurseries, and then they'll bring them out to each of the individual partners. And they tend to do that, you know, just once or twice a year. So that was like the one thing about the Northwest Oregon Restoration Partnership. that I wasn't sure how useful it could be to us, but they don't ask for us to do anything for it, so I figured it's just a benefit for us to be involved. So the benefit that actually Salmon-Drift Creek Watershed Council having a nursery on site is there potentially is going to be plants available for us all year depending on their need for the plants, okay. But they'd be on site. We might be able to select the species that they would grow there, but then also if there's extra space at the nursery or just at the grounds, when you know, we don't have anywhere to put the plants is kind of the issue. So that one-time delivery, you know, where are we going to put 1,000 plants? There's the potential that we could store them at the nursery that they have.
The real thing about this is that the Watershed Council is trying to do is take advantage of all the BLM money that's out there right now and those supplies to build the nursery. You know, because that's really what's driving this is the fact that BLM has this project that they're willing to help fund, and Salmon-Drift Creek Watershed Council is just trying to get the capacity effectively to do that. And that's what this other grant is that they're looking at writing, which we would provide the match to. So they're all really tied together. And I mean, the BLM is looking at, you know, basically providing all of the resources to start a whole nursery, which would be an education opportunity for the high school indefinitely, effectively, which is really positive, I think.
Right, and it would be a benefit for us too. Having we can tap into that educational person if they receive the grant, which is for a person. That's another like educational person that we can tap into. And I mean, it's having all those native plants right on site, I think, is good, you know, for homeowners too. They can just run up there and have a look at what's available.
All right. So I guess I'll make a motion that we write a letter of support sponsoring up to 180.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Carries unanimously.
And then the quick final thing, I just wanted to give you guys an update. We got we've pretty much all the costs in now for the East Devil's Lake rain garden that we did there. So there's just a spreadsheet there looking at the cost for it. The one that I had a hole in was the pavers that we used to keep the black plastic down. And we estimate that was about $100. I didn't have that number available to me. But as you can see, the total project cost then is about $9,862 to do that project. And then, you know, plant materials there for that project was about $3,000. So if we can, if we have a bigger project and we are able to tap into plants for something else, you know, cut the cost down by about a third on a project of that size. So plants aren't cheap, that's for sure.
Vegetation management.
Okay, so we got basically two parts of this, and I'm going to cover the first part, and then David, we'll let him take over during an internship part. But the work that David Phillips has done over the last month is vital in this component. Thanks to Brian Green there for reviewing the contract that we got from Max Depth Aquatics for this lead scientist role, and we've gotten a signed copy back in the mail just yesterday, so we can basically move this forward as far as having the contractor in place and at the $33,000 full contract that we approved last meeting. I've been compiling, digitizing, I guess, some of the records we've gotten from ODF&W because I think that's the simplest way to get them all this paperwork that we received from ODF&W. So that's ongoing. I've got a request in to get a database of all the grass carp plantings statewide. Fish and Wildlife is working on that. They said that we'd have that by the end of January, hopefully. So hopefully they're still on board with that time frame. And, you know, just as an overlook of the strategic plan that we've been developing and amending, you know, obviously this lead scientist that was the next big hurdle that we're taking on right now. But, you know, to get an approved application, we're going to have to do a number of other things, too. Having an engineered stamped watershed assessment, I guess, if you will. Like, basically, we have to have a topographic survey done again, which I'm confident all the data is there. You know, I mean, especially all the LIDAR data that we've talked about, how intense that detail that stuff is. That stuff's going to qualify, in my estimation. I'm not an engineer, though. So, but I think that's something that we can look forward to starting to work on, if that's, you know, the recommendation from the board. I'll look at investigating an engineer for that part of it, or maybe it's a little premature, I don't know. But we would need that as part of, you know, an approved application. You know, we aren't at the point where we can actually apply yet, as you know, because we have all these other obstacles regarding the statute, you know, changing the language. But if we get to that point, we'll need that. So I guess maybe we could kind of phase it as far as collecting information as to what it would cost and who could do it for us, and then look at pulling the trigger on that at a different time. If that might be the best way forward on that.
And we need to know how long it will take
to actually do the topographic survey. Yeah, and that would be something I could put together too. I wouldn't imagine it's going to take long. It's really, the data are there, you know. I mean, as far as I could tell, you know, we have high level data on our computers at home. You know, I mean, it's the fact that, you know, the inputs and outputs are known. You know, basically this stems from when people are providing new applications, you know, to ODFMW. They want to know that you're outside of a floodplain, that you're not. They know all the inlets and outlets of the watershed and that sort of thing. Well, for us, we know those pretty clearly. But ODFMW is going to require that formal document, I think, too. Again, so.
I think as we get closer and you know when we need to do it, you know, I think we'll have to look into, you know, initiating the RFP process.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's kind of what I think we need to do, is just be kind of geared up on all these things. The other one is the just a vegetation assessment. You know, we talked about this in previous meetings, that, you know, you really need a acre assessment of the acreage that you need to apply for, you know, and, you know, where the need is and that sort of thing. So having all of those, you know, expert opportunities pinpointed down or nailed down, I guess, I think will serve us pretty well, because they're going to be required. I mean, those are part of, like, just the generic applications as they exist right now.
Well, I mean, is development of an RFP dependent on what we get from on getting information from Mr. Eilers, or can we just go ahead and get it done
now? No, not on, like, a topographic survey, I wouldn't think. No, because, no. I mean, it's just you know, what does the landscape look like, and the same thing with the aquatic vegetation. You know, it's just like, well, how much aquatic vegetation do you have? You know, it's just kind of numbers.
I'd rather see us just get going on that right now, so we don't create any bottlenecks in his timeline in terms of just moving this thing forward.
Maybe over the next month you could develop the RFPs and we can review them February.
Okay, we could. Yeah, we could shoot for that. You bet.
Is there anything else on that to talk about?
Yeah, no. Thank you, though.
Are we covering this on the intern?
Yeah. We'll take that after a bit here.
So, Brian Green, sewer.
Yeah, I don't have much to report. My understanding is that Mr. Crimp, the engineer, has... I've given him my final inputs, which he's graciously asked for, and I've been happy to provide it. And I thought we were at the point of him being able to submit a final report to the city almost a month ago, and he may have done that. I haven't seen it. I've seen the last draft, which was very close to the final. So that's either sitting on city staff's desk, or he hasn't yet submitted it. And that's that's all about the additional progress that I know at this point. I'll actually check with him and Stephanie Reed, the city engineer, before the next meeting if I haven't heard anything in the meantime, because it seems like it's kind of languishing a little bit. So that concludes my report.
Erosion study, Paul.
Okay, so from the I got an update just today from Tetra Tech here relative to this report. You know, as we went through last meeting, you know, it was really staff's assessment that it was really incomplete, the report as it sat. I'll just read this to you. It says, Tetra Tech appreciates the opportunity to improve the erosion study report and its associated deliverables. It is our intent to deliver a final product that was within the spirit and details of the contract. To that end, we have reviewed comments provided by the district and have reorganized portions of the report to more clearly present our assessment and information not previously included, and as examples, vegetation recruitment, DSL, and ODFW acceptable bank stabilization options. It is apparent the district expected more detailed information and a synthesis on how changes in lake level affect various shoreline conditions. For example, how might the lake at one level affect the establishment of emergent vegetation, or conversely, how and where does existing vegetation absorb wave energy? So we have attempted to bolster these types of discussions within the limits of available information, and where applicable, emphasize that expected outcomes and subsequent recommendations are only possible on a gross scale. Tetra Tech will be discussing these updates with Paul, myself, in the upcoming days and provide a final report to the board January 23rd. In addition to the changes to the report, the following deliverables will be provided to the district via digitally. Geo-rectified historic aerials, which were not previously provided. Historic aerials incorporated as a short wave WMV file, animation file. Hard copies of the field data sheets and inundation maps incorporated as a short movie file, animation file again, too. So that's what I have for you, and expect to see a whole, for the board as well, a final copy of this on the 23rd.
I guess my only challenge with that is that I want to make sure that you have time to review it, write comments, and allow the board to review that prior to, you know, being able to accept the deliverable. And I think it's going to be tight against doing that in the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 days before the meeting.
Right. Yeah.
So
I guess it just depends on how well they nail it down.
So
you know,
they work with you. Give you a little insight before the 23rd, because if they drop it on the 23rd, it's going to take you a couple, you know, 2-3
oh, yeah,
to get through it.
And yeah. And in fact, I have a
push it back on us even closer to.
Sure. I've got a request with she's got a request of me, and I've got a request for Tony, Dr. Pennington, to have a conversation next week, early next week, to go over some of these things. So. You know, obviously, we want to get the thing done. They want to get the thing done as well. And I think that they're, you know, providing this 23rd week of, or 23rd day in January is a kind of a middle point. You know, if we can't accept it in February, we can't accept it in February. That'll be just how it'll go. Hopefully, we can, and it'll be up to the specs meeting the RFP and the contract. So, you know, that's where we are, and I hear what you're saying, though. You know, as far as
I just don't want the dates to push you into, you know, cutting short your analysis of the deliverable and making sure that it meets the RFP requirements.
Sure.
So, but if it does, and we all have our time to review it, then that's fine. It's potentially something that we can accept as a deliverable in February, but. Just let them know that timelines are going to be tight.
Okay,
they're
we'll
going
do.
To push it that far into late January.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a topic for review and approval in March.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, Paul, when I wasn't in on the first when this study was ordered, so I might be completely missing the boat.
But what I was looking for out of the study was the answer to the question, is raising the level of the lake detrimental to the health of the lake? And at the end of the, in the summary, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not even sure I got it right, but Tetra Tech said that they basically could find, they couldn't find, they didn't have enough evidence available to show that it was detrimental to the health of the lake. Am I, was I reading that correctly?
Yeah, what they said is that the variability, the change between a half a foot, which is all that they ended up looking at, which was incomplete as far as what we asked for, that within that little bandwidth, they were not able to basically tease out anything that would make a difference, that the overriding effects of wave energy are greater than what that bandwidth could even pinpoint. And a lot of the problem was the fact is, you know, as good as the data are, they have this like plus or minus 1 foot kind of level of sensitivity in the data. And so that's half of the height that we were even looking at. What I think was interpreted by that, you know, we couldn't find anything at that half foot interval, at least is what I've heard from people, is oh, it just doesn't matter what height the lake is. And, you know, I would argue or would like to have see validation that, well, then if, you know, you say you jack it up the lake to 11 feet, you know, that to me there's, at some point there's going to be an impact. And what they didn't address in their presentation was where the energy was hitting, not they didn't get the where, just the how. You know, they developed very good information about how the wave energy is created, and they used that as the overriding kind of concept when they made that assumption. But you know, they didn't actually look at the where. You know, if it is just a half a foot, or if it's a foot, 2 feet. Because I mean, we're talking about an impoundment regime that goes from basically 8.3 feet to 9.53 feet.
Well, my concern is just because you didn't get the evidence doesn't mean there isn't evidence.
Correct. Right.
And then when I see here, it reads within the limits of the available information. There's a line here. We have attempted to bolster these types of discussions within the limits of the available information. Now, if they didn't have that information before, how are they going to have it now?
Well, one thing that they'll have to look at is the different impoundment regimes. So instead of just looking at that half a foot from 9.0 to 9.53, they're going to have to look at the full impoundment regime as requested from like 8.0 from non-impoundment, you know, from basically not operating a dam in the summertime through operating it at its full extent. So there's additional parameters within that. But I get what you're saying. But there's what the feedback that I think was really also lacking was just, you know, there was no synthesis of this information about saturated soils and you know, the shoreline and what's happening. It's just, you know, It got broken up into a wave energy study and some photographic survey type stuff on vegetation and what the riprap looks like around the lake, not a synthesized final report on all those things. And so that was a pretty large omission, you know, in that report.
So after these folks correct their study, are we going to know definitively whether raising the level of the lake is detrimental to the lake?
Well, I mean,
isn't that what we paid for? Was that initially the question that we wanted answered?
I mean, It was one of the questions. You know, and knowing the difficulty in getting that answer specifically. You know, if you wanted something you could, you know, bet on every time, and you know you were right either way, it was going to be difficult. And knowing that that was going to be a difficult answer to find, to determine, we wrote the RFP to create other value in the product, specifically like a shoreline assessment of vegetation, of the photographic survey around the lake, and really looking to get some, you know, best, you know, like professional judgment on these other things that maybe you can't tease out, but you can look at, say, you know, is there a probability that you're impacting the shoreline? Those types of things. We're not paying for a complete statistical probability study though either. I don't want to, suggest that that's going to come out either. But to answer your question, I don't honestly know if we'll know exactly because I haven't seen that. What the final product will look like. It would be a goal, certainly something that we're interested in.
Could I interrupt here? Kip keeps saying that the answer to this question will tell us whether or not the lake's health is at risk. And I think we're only talking about erosion. And you could have greater erosion and a healthier lake. I mean, if you have a greater depth, you may have fewer adverse types of plants. The growth rate may be less. So I don't really want to discuss this research in terms of whether or not the lake will be less or more healthy as a result of whatever we do after we get the answers. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think this determines lake health. I mean, if we have more erosion, that may not be the worst thing in the world.
This would be one thing that would factor into it, but it's not the point of the overall document.
You call it lake's health. I mean, what I'm trying to find out is raising the level of the water of the lake, is it something that we want that is beneficial or it's not? I mean, that's a pretty simple question.
Well, in some terms, it is. And
question in terms of erosion.
Yeah.
But, okay, even using that criteria, was there an answer there?
Well,
that's kind of up to the scientists.
Yeah, I think when we get the final deliverable, know to what extent we have an answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if we can tell them to give us an answer because it may not be within sufficient scientific certainty or probability that they can say. We hope they can, but we're not the experts that we can push them for more information like we have, but the final opinion has to come from them.
Okay. And that is part of it, is just to try to ensure that they're, relaying the confidence of those assertions. It's like, and I think you alluded to it a long time ago, just because you're, even stated, just because you don't have evidence doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and that, that the things that are showing up on your report are, should include that kind of information. You should include what you don't know. And, maybe that's a tough thing for a client contract relationship to have. Well, we don't know. Please pay us. That's a tough sell. So, but I think that's important, and I've pushed for that too. I'd rather know that you don't know than just have, some unclear.
I just think that there are people looking for answers from the study, and I'm not certain that it provided them. Maybe it did.
Well, it obviously didn't provide what we asked for. Why it's back and being more work done on it by them, right? And I would expect that some of the things that we're going to see are some of the assumptions around why certain things came out the way they did, right? Not just blanket, there's nothing here to report, right? To help us that we understand what drew them to the conclusions, right? And having that pulled together, and I think until we see the document, we're not going to have those answers.
Fair enough.
But it's a great discussion for, I think, for February, because I think we'll all have a chance to read through it by then.
Well, I have a feeling.
Yeah. Did they work with them, Kip, during the... Well, they're working with Paul. You're welcome to...
Nah. I'm already the dumbest guy in the room. I don't want to
say that. Okay.
I object.
Okay, communications report.
So I'll just kind of quickly go through this, but you know, basically, our December meetings are airing on Channel 4. Our December meeting aired on Channel 4. Our January meetings airing on Channel 4. There's a link on our website to that schedule. It repeats daily, almost. The audio is now available on our website, too. So as soon as we get the audio back from the city, we post that online. Thanks to Seth, we had a great Clearwater e-newsletter go out for December, or for the winter, highlighting the King Tides and the intern program, SOS program, and some holiday fun. And lastly, just the social media aspect. We did a nice tweet tonight. I don't know how important that is to folks, but we did announce our meetings tonight, and we've got 68 followers on Facebook. And we really use that to just kind of generate, I guess, interest and vibe. And really, the website and these meetings are the crux of the district. You know, we're not extending ourselves to the social media realm in a way that, you know, doesn't that takes away from this meeting, because it's really what goes on in these meetings is where the district operates. So, but there definitely increases interest in about the district and the lake, and that's important. So, that's all I got.
So, along I did notice something on Channel 4 that the city uses it to you know, query out there for budget committee members.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering if, you know, you could look into having those, you know, little news flashes up, you know, for the district when the time comes.
Yeah, in fact, we have
a little bit of a challenge.
We have had a whole PowerPoint slideshow run on that channel in years past. So as far as, like, you know, getting a slide on that PowerPoint for any number of things, or multiple slides, a whole, you know, program, you know, that's something we could do again.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll look into that.
Discussion or comment? Patients? Safety report?
All right.
Looks like no accidents, so we're good there. Audit?
Hey, so we had our independent accountant complete their assessment of the district's finances. Copy can be found online. Posted that on our website. It's also been sent to the Secretary of State's Audits Division, so they'll have a copy that people can download as soon as they, you know, get their archives up. We are not, you know, having you know, a presentation of this audit, as you know, tonight. That would have been typically what happened with a full audit. We're getting a review right now, so that's you know, not part of the contract. But you know, the audit is available. Did people get a chance to look at that at all? I have the paper copies. I can bring over. Neglected to bring them tonight, but I can certainly run over and grab them before tonight, or people can stop by and pick up their own copy. We've got printed copies for the board, as usual.
Stop by and pick one up.
Yeah. There's plenty available. But it is online too. You know, in short, you know, we had a good report. There was no indication of any material concern identified in the report. So that basically is a good report. you know, the report did include our own management discussion and analysis, which was about 7 pages. So we have a large role in this product as well, and it's really meant for us to be digesting, I guess, the information and then regurgitating it in a more layman's term than what the accountant provides. And so that's what we included. I threw in a little graph here from that report just so you could take a look at the net assets for the district, which have been increasing steadily since 2005-2006. We've moved from about 300,000 to 550,000, 540,000. And those are unrestricted assets. Those are mostly in our bank accounts. One thing that we did last year was, which will be reflected in the following audit, is we transferred an extra $25,000 into our unappropriated ending fund balance. So instead of having $75,000 to run the following year, we have $100,000. So when we started July 1 this year, we had $100,000 in the bank. Well, we are also able to, in this current fiscal year, transfer a sizable amount of money into our savings account, the improvement fund, which would have been $25,000 more if we hadn't just saved it within the general fund. So when you look at these data through the budget process, we want to keep that in mind as to, you know, how much we're spending, how much we are saving, and that sort of thing. But so there's a lot of information in that report to look at for the budget process, which, speaking of which, I've been working with the city to organize an opportunity that we could have our budget hearings here. Would that be favorable?
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought. The first Monday after our meeting in May is generally when we hold it. They couldn't commit at that time to that because that might be in conflict with their budget hearings, because they generally hold them on a Monday as well. So are there days that are, or evenings, or that people would like to look at, and I can try to schedule that in? Because generally in January I would have had the budget calendar ready for you too at this point, but I just wasn't able to do that because of you know, the city is, if we're going to use this facility, we need to make sure it works within their schedule as well.
If it is during the week, generally speaking, for me, Wednesdays and Fridays are probably better.
Okay.
Thursdays and Tuesdays are.
Would Friday after our Thursday meeting?
That would seem like a reasonable time.
Or is that just like too much meetings back to back? That
I mean, that,
like, say, if we have our meeting May 5th and May 6th, we'd have our budget hearing in the daytime. Or in the evening. I mean, it's, you know, it's just kind of for the last few years we've done it the following Monday in the daytime, and that was to kind of let people that were on the board that were out of town, you know, come in on Thursday and stay through Monday, you know, and work and kind of come to the meeting. It doesn't have to be in the daytime. It doesn't have to be on Monday. It could be on a Saturday.
I won't be here Saturdays in May. Hopefully something.
You want to shoot for a Friday after our Thursday night meeting in May? Okay, great. We'll look to do that. So that's pretty much what I have for you on the audit. Are there any things that I can answer? I mean,
I don't have any specific questions.
Just to be clear, or maybe not clear, are the assets basically...
Yeah, and the capital assets of the I'm sorry.
Your truck and thing.
It's actually the truck and the structure at the D River. Those are the two major capital assets that we're depreciating.
And the boat.
And the boat. Yeah, there's a small list. The boat may be already depreciated out. Frankly, that might not even be included in that, because once you've depreciated it goes beyond an asset. It's almost like it just disappears. So that's why this number is in this graph. The darker portion of the bottom is trailing down because it's depreciating down. And we haven't really bought a lot of new assets. I mean, we bought the scientific equipment for the cyanobacteria and, you know, computers and things like that. But they, you know, they depreciate at a different rate than, say, the truck too. They schedule that in a different way, how it depreciates.
Okay, that's all I was wondering about.
Oh, Kip, anything?
Not here.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to David. He's going to have a presentation for us. I'll hit the...
So this is just like a quick slideshow I put together recently just to kind of signify the work I've done in the last month. This report here is kind of the meat of everything. This is just kind of a quick advantages and disadvantages to each of the management strategies that I kind of outlined in the report. Beginning with mechanical harvesting, so as you can see, the advantages are that they do create immediate results. They, you know, cut huge swaths through the milfoil and the vegetation, and they really open up pathways for boats quickly and immediately. That's a huge advantage, whereas many of the other strategies are kind of more long-term benefits, but they're much slower and take a lot more time. There are contracting companies that can contract this job out to. For the most part, they're on the East Coast or in the Midwest. There's only one that I found on the West Coast based out of Sacramento, California. Their contact info is in the report as well. So disadvantages that come along with mechanical harvesters is that they are a pretty high initial cost. They do come in a very wide range of sizes. I actually recently found ones that were as small as, you know, just 10-foot pontoon boats to ones that are up to 40 feet in length. The larger ones cost anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000. Operating costs range from anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000. Per year. That's the harvester working all summer long. It's estimated that they would probably have to cut the lake at least twice throughout the growing season, like May through the end of September. It's very similar to mowing your lawn. You cut it, it's going to regrow again. In many studies done, it's been seeing that once you cut it once, the plants tend to grow back at even a more dense rate. It's not really seen as a long-term solution because it's not going to the source of the problem. You keep cutting them back, they're going to keep growing them back. It's almost, in fact, you know, inspiring it to grow back. So as I said, the lake just must be constantly mowed with these. Suction harvesting is more of a long-term benefit where it really attacks the root system of the plants, where a diver actually goes down to the bottom and really removes the entire plant along with the roots, and then it sucks it to the surface. The suction is really just an advantage. It speeds up the process rather than having to keep the plants and roots in a bag and make returning trips to the surface. The diver can stay down below while the suction pump just sucks to the surface, where someone at the surface collects it into bags, and the bags can then be disposed of later. These are seen as dredges by the state of Oregon, so permits are needed. Even though sediment's not removed, all the sediment's replaced. It does stir up a lot of the sediment. The use of a turbidity curtain would probably be required. Dredge permits would be required too. As the cost is outlined here in the report, they can be ran by a two-man team to a four-man team depending on the size of the harvester acquired. These machines range from anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000. I was only able to find, and as far as I know, there's only one company that actually builds them out of New York. I spoke with Jerry Davis, the owner of that company, recently. He's been doing it for a long time. They've been doing this for about 20 years. They've really, really improved boat design from what they are. There's quite a few lake associations that actually build these themselves, and it would be possible for the district to build this themselves. The benefit to working with a company like Jerry's is that they've been doing it for so long, they've kind of worked out a lot of the kinks, so to speak. It just kind of decreases the learning curve working with someone who's been doing this for a while. Whereas if we were to build our own, it would decrease our cost, it would increase time being put into it. And the learning curve would be much higher. Bottom barriers are another method that have proved very effective in that they kill, you know, everything beneath them. They completely block out the sunlight, preventing all the vegetation from photosynthesizing. Relatively quickly, too, and they're best placed within the winter or the spring before vegetation's really grown. They can be placed over, you know, already grown vegetation, but it does take about a month for it to kill everything, and they must remain in place longer at that time in order to destroy all the vegetation. And what happens when, as they're placed over live vegetation, as that vegetation decomposes, gas buildup occurs, which can cause these barriers to balloon up, which could cause a hazard in the lake, especially with boaters, props getting tangled up in these things and whatnot. Barriers are made out of many different things, such as synthetic material like plastics, much like a pond lining, or they can be out of burlap. Burlap's been seen to degrade pretty quickly. Synthetics do last longer, slightly higher cost. They're very effective on a smaller scale, such as around boat docks or boat launches or swimming areas. They do create an immediate effect, which is very nice. And they can actually be moved once they kill all the vegetation every 3 to 4 weeks. They do need to be inspected fairly often, as the anchors can fail and they can balloon up and cause hazards, or sediment can be deposited on top of them, in which case plants can just start growing on top of them. It's been seen that they need to be maintained or inspected about every 1 to 2 weeks or so. It's just, they're not incredibly cost effective on a large scale either. It's not necessarily a lake-wide technique, but it's very effective on smaller scales and shallower waters. In deeper waters, they require divers and things like that to be placed. Hand pulling is another technique that's very effective on smaller scales. It's much like pulling the weeds in your garden. It's very effective in shallow waters, areas around boat docks, boat launches, swimming areas. They are good because they have no, you know, detrimental effects to the environment. They don't affect the fish and wildlife. They do disturb sediments, but it quickly redeposits within a day. It's also very cheap on small scales. It's very good because work parties could be set up. Create like a big volunteer day, get people out there, get them interested, get them involved with cleaning up the lake. It's possible to hire people. It's similar to landscaping. You could hire a crew of 2 or 3 guys who spend their time throughout the summer pulling weeds in the lake. excuse me. I'm sorry, I've frozen up. Nerves. Anyway. So disadvantages of hand pulling is it's very slow. It's labor intensive. Once again, it does get the root system of the plants. It's seen as a longer term process. If you pull plants 1 year, you're not going to pull as many plants the next year. That's one great advantage of this. As I said before, it's not effective in deeper water. It's much more time consuming. It requires the use of either divers or things called hookah systems. These hookah systems are systems in which air compressors are used at the surface to supply air to divers. It eliminates the need for the divers to actually be scuba certified, which is really good on insurance, from an insurance point of view and a cost point of view if you're to employ people, and it's also much safer. once again, though, it's very labor-intensive, and is also not really necessarily a lake-wide method. So this kind of concludes. These are the 4 kind of main strategies I've outlined. The report really has a lot of the specific costs and things in there. if any of you guys have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
First of all, it's good work. Thanks. We appreciate you.
Yes, thank you, David.
Spending some time on this. You know, I think, you know, I was looking at it, and there's a lot of good information in here, and I think one thing that might help me is kind of just an overall pros and cons table with a cost structure to it across the alternatives, so that you can see the advantages, disadvantages, and then projected cost, and whether it's, you know, a localized, lake-wide potential approach. That would be easier for me to pull it out sitting here, but that's okay.
No, I understand that.
I think if we can do that, you know, great.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Kim?
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Why did you pick out these four? There must have been others.
There are. There's actually, I was really amazed at how many different strategies there are. There's herbicides, there's other mechanical controls and physical controls. These were the four that Paul really wanted me to kind of look at.
You have in here suction harvesting, okay, with the small, that looked like a small dredge.
Yeah.
But you're not really talking about dredging, correct?
No, the way the suction harvester works is there is a diver down at the bottom, or in shallower waters there's need to be a diver, but they pull out the plant system, and the plants are then sucked up to the surface. The way that works is the plants then go through a filtration system, such as a mesh bag or something, where the sediment actually, you know, goes through that bag, but it retains the plant. So the sediment then resettles to the bottom. It does increase turbidity a lot in the area, and the use of turbidity curtains would probably be required.
And I probably missed it, but did you cover at all in any of those the disposal of plants, whether that was a problem or?
Yeah, sorry, that's another thing I should have talked about. It is outlined in the report. Disposal of plants could be a cost if, you know, one thing that could happen is these can be composted. So if there's like an agricultural area, say somewhere that wanted to actually take them on, they could, you know, save them and use them for compost, and hopefully that could be found for free. Otherwise, they have to go to the landfill. That's going to, you know, require a cost. For example, the Lincoln County landfill here, the North Lincoln Sanitary charges, I think it's $6 per cubic yard of plant debris. Now, I'm sure that something could be contracted with them for a lower cost. Ideally, you could find somewhere to compost them, even possibly around the lake. I mean, that area could be found. It's plant matter. You kind of want it away from the lake. As plants fragment, they can recolonize in other areas. So,
Paul, what percentage of the bottom of the lake right now is vegetated?
Best guess, less than 2%.
So basically, we have about a 98% clean slate.
Yeah.
All right. So, did you have any feeling as you're looking at these solutions that are pretty labor intensive? I would assume that'll vary between a lake that would be fully involved in weeds and one that has 98% no weeds.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any feelings on the ability of somebody out there with a pump being able to actually have some effect on that?
Yeah, in my research, I actually found in, I believe it's Halverson Lake, there's a lake in New York where 98% of the milfoil was eradicated over a course of 5 years using hand-pulling methods, hand-pulling and suction harvesting. They did not use mechanical harvesters. They wanted to go for the root of the problem. They didn't want the weed to return. And within 5 years, they pretty much eradicated most of it. After that time, they went into a maintenance period where they had a much smaller crew patrol the lake all summer long, kind of make sure that the plants weren't spreading as much as they used to be, or as dense as they used to be. It was seen that this was pretty effective. They were able to keep these plants down. there was still regrowth, but in a much more easily maintained amount.
How big was that lake?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to think. It's look this up. It was much larger than Devil's Lake. It was, I think, on the order of 500 hectares.
Must have been shallow then, really shallow.
It wasn't the entire lake that needed harvesting. It was mainly in the littoral zone, so which is just kind of the outline of the lake, just in the areas where it was growing. But it was a very large lake and much larger than Devil's Lake.
I know you're just an intern, but what do you think? Did you have any thought to how big of a crew it would take to maintain Devil's Lake?
My personal opinion would be that at current vegetation levels being what they are, very low, I think it could be pretty easily obtained with a pretty small crew of just two, maybe three people kind of patrolling the lake all summer long. And really what it would take is just kind of spotting the problem early and dealing with it as quickly as possible rather than, you know, letting it get to the point of where it's out of control. That's when you've got a big problem. If you keep it down before it can really get out of control, it can, I think, easily be controlled by a small crew, two guys probably, maybe three tops.
Well, now it's my understanding that it's desirable to have 20% vegetation in the lake. Would that be easier to do with, I mean, can you actually sculpt the lake if that's what you want to do? Can you encourage certain plant growth and discourage other?
I think it's very possible. One high benefit to the methods such as suction harvesting or hand pulling is that they're very species selective. So you can really target things such as Eurasian water milfoil, which really chokes out native vegetation, and you can select for that native vegetation to regrow. And as that takes root, it can outcompete the Eurasian water milfoil. So,
yeah, I was actually reading through your report. I was totally surprised at the damage that mechanical harvesting had done to the wildlife. I had no idea. Thank you.
Yeah, that's another large issue is that with a population of native coho using the lake as rearing habitat, it is possible that will have to be reviewed probably by NOAA or Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I did run it by the Licking County Department of Fish and Wildlife, and there are 3 to 30% fish kill ratios with these mechanical harvesters. These have all these studies have been done on the East Coast and the Midwest, and there's no studies done in the Pacific Northwest. They don't know if it might be different with salmonids. Most of the population has all been sunfish. So,
yeah, well, thank you very much. This is great.
Thank you.
Would it be true that city, but
well, the 10 to 15 marker is it a dense vegetation? So, well. For an example, if you remove say Eurasian water milfoil from like a 1 acre area, it's seen to grow back at anywhere from 10 to 50%. Now it's highly reduced. That's at most 50% reduced after you remove the roots. That over the next year, like so. Say for the first growing year, you removed it from an area, completely, entirely wiped it out. It's been seen to grow back the following year, 10 to 50%. Those rates vary in studies done.
Because I don't know what that is.
I wouldn't think it is. I know it's not.
So the invasive plant's out.
Mm-hmm.
So
Yeah, one advantage of yeah, it would be my idea that could happen over time, and as that study was done in the New York Lake, the natural vegetation does come back and replace it, which is why they go into what's called just the maintenance period, where they have a smaller crew maintaining the milfoil. But the milfoil, I mean, things like Eurasian water milfoil, which are highly invasive, can reestablish themselves and begin to choke out the native plants again if they're allowed to, which is why they need to be maintained. I'm sorry, does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. More or less.
Of, competition between... oil early enough, 20% established. It's kind of.
Mm-hmm. I think it's entirely possible to, using, a different aspect, multiple aspects of these strategies, to really keep it down to a level where it's, basically non-existent. Like the problem is that I don't think you're ever really going to have 100% eradication. A major issue is that it can be reintroduced in the future by boaters coming in.
Sure.
That is a huge issue. The fact that it was in the lake in the past also, gives evidence that it could come back when the grass carp quit feeding on it. One also issue I found with, just to bring up the grass carp, I guess, is that they feed on Eurasian water milfoil. The grass carp have been seen to have specific feeding tendencies, and one of their problems is that they feed on native vegetation before they feed on water milfoil. So that eliminates the native vegetation first, and then they attack the milfoil. As the vegetation begins to regrow and the natives come back, and so will water milfoil, if we can, select for that native vegetation by removing the milfoil early on, then I do believe that that the native vegetation will have a good chance of outcompeting the milfoil for a long time. But I believe that it requires the help of us before we let it, outcompete the natives.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm talking in circles here, kind of.
No, very helpful. Thank you. Close enough.
Okay.
I have no further questions.
Yeah, great job.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I'd just echo that, too. Thank you very much for your work. Yeah, this is a lot of information thus far in these four different, and they're all 3 pages each. There's a lot to go through. So,
well, that's a nice concept, because if it works, it would also provide some employment that the city desperately needs.
Yeah, any of those, bottom barriers, or any of the number of those different things, you're definitely going to, you're going to want to. Train up a few people and get it done locally, yeah.
I just don't envision a 2-man crew doing the job. I mean, because
more employment.
I look at a road crew, like was over on East Devil's Lake Road today. They're cutting trees. They got a flagger on each side. You got people under the water. You're going to have protection for the area that they're working in.
Yeah.
They have guys manning boats. I don't see it being less than probably a 4 to 6 man crew working a situation like that at any one given time.
Yeah, I could see that being true too. Yeah, I mean it's a variable that we haven't really got a truth fix on.
You know, if it's in front of your own place, yeah, it's you and your buddy are out there pulling weeds, right? But I think that for us to move, look at that. I think it's the crew that would have to do it would be different. I think in nature, just by the what I see on the road when people can visually see you at all times.
Right. There are groups that do it with 2 or 3 man, groups. So, they're obviously doing it out there in certain lakes. I take your point. I mean, from a safety issue, if you got somebody in the water, you need at least one person on top of the water. And that's not even one person moving the weeds away from there. There's potentially more.
Is it possible that we could... David could get a hold of those New York people and see what their system works, how that works?
It is possible. I can try. All the information I've obtained is from Benson Scientific Studies.
As far as the New York folks that have the denuded lake that just keep it under corral with the small crew, they should be able to share with us, what their crew size and expenses had been, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I think you had a video on that one, actually.
What's that?
The Aqua Cleaner? Is that the one? He actually has a video link. As you go through this document, there's photographs, and then where there's a video, I asked him just to put that link, too. So if we go to that website, you can see some of this going on firsthand.
Do you have electronic copies of the source, the scientific studies that you used for this? Like, if we wanted to read about the harvesting in Norway?
I do, yeah. If you're more interested, I can send you... I've got numerous PDF files and things that I've downloaded to the computer I've had for use.
Just like to dig sometimes after I read that.
Yeah.
There's something about this that I'd have to know before I'd even put any stock in this, and that would be the topography of that lake compared to ours. Ours is very shallow, and it's a smaller lake. And from my memory, and I came in 85 when everything was at its worst, there was weeds everywhere. You go out in the middle of the lake. Well, in fact, in front of the regatta grounds, there was an island in the middle of the lake. Now, this lake that... Right. And I know in front of me, because I went out and harvested a lot of it myself. I tried. And this lake may be much deeper, may not even have a weed problem away from the shoreline. Maybe that's, you said, the littoral zone. Maybe that littoral zone was only within 50 feet of the edge of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been much, and therefore they didn't have to worry about, obviously they didn't have to worry about the deeper portions of the lake because they didn't treat those. So therefore, and in our case, you might get these weeds. If, let's say, we decided to go to a 3-man crew now, or a 10-man crew, whatever, and get rid of the carp, we might find out that those weeds were coming up in the middle of the lake where these guys can't go. And I think he said something about 4 feet was the...
I think that was for...
Best.
Well, that's best without...
Well, that might have been the other, but...
Excuse me.
Okay. But go ahead.
With hand harvesting, it's best in shallower waters. The use of suction harvesting is... There are divers employed with that, and they can go deeper. From my study, what I've seen is, obviously, I've never known the lake the way it used to be. I was born in 1990. I've never known it the way it used to be when it was choked out with weeds. My understanding from my research is that milfoil doesn't grow very much below 10 to 12 feet.
Yeah, and
the average depth of the lake is much shallower.
About 10 feet or less.
Yes.
There's only a few areas that go over that.
Mm-hmm.
So really, when you start talking about the topography of the lake below the surface of the water, you're looking at the potential to maintain about 95% of that submerged surface area by hand, right? So it may, just
every lake is different. You know,
yeah.
You're deep, steep canyons in a lake. You're dropping deep water fast. You don't get the same kind of growth that we have, or potential for growth that we have. So,
mm-hmm. One quick question: how many months out of the year would that team work?
My estimates were based on the 1st of May to the end of September, which I estimate to be as the primary growing season.
Okay.
The winter months, plants mostly go kind of dormant.
You know, you could run crews in the winter, though, and that's when, you know, you might actually be most effective, because I know one of the things that you looked at, or I remember hearing, is that if with any of these controls, if you you do it ahead of time, you don't wait till mid-July when it's already 6 feet tall, you kind of go after it. And so, I mean, there's a potential that you could just run it, you know, around the clock. And maybe in those higher, you know, boating zone areas, you go out and do that in the wintertime and hope that it, you know, holds off. You know, I mean, obviously there's growth year round, but you know, so I mean, there is a potential to do it, I guess, at a you know, longer scale too, with benefit. You know, whereas with the mowers type, it's more just in the summertime. But if you're getting at the roots, then I think year round you could be, you know, effectively getting at those roots.
Thanks. Program, Paul.
Actually, I'm going to... That's all right. Okay, so I actually just kind of re-updated this history of the CyanoWatch program from the last time we had a look at this, and I'm just going to go through it kind of quickly. It just kind of summarizes what we did and where we may be going. We started the CyanoWatch program, has its roots in 2005. We didn't do anything in that year, but that's the first year that the state said they had these new guidelines for monitoring cyanobacteria, and that meeting took place on August 11, 2005. No action was taken during that sampling year. In 06, we didn't do any sampling or monitoring per se, but we started putting out this information. Signage here is represented by this green sign. And what we've done is we've done a green, yellow, red. And as you'll see, year to year, that has changed. But this is what it kind of looked like that first year. In 07, we started actually monitoring for the cyanobacteria. We were doing cell counts. We were putting out these green publications. If the values were started to look like they were shooting up, we'd put out this caution sheet, which was kind of the yellow. And then if we actually had an alert that was above the threshold that the state had set, we'd put this posting here. So, and this is what those signs look like at the time. In 2008, we went to our first year of cyanotoxin testing, the microcystin. And we did cell counts as well, but we found that the toxin testing makes the most sense for us, at least. And we basically use the same posting protocol as shown here. Sampling was done primarily at the near shore, though, and as you see, that changed in the following year. In 2009, we were in our second year of toxin analysis. We did had our third year of cell counts, but we changed the sampling protocol slightly. We started using composite sampling so that we were taking 9 subsamples from regatta grounds, 9 subsamples from Sandpoint, 9 subsamples from the middle of the lake, and making individual samples out of each one of those. In fact, we had 12, expanded it to 12 sites, so we were taking 12 times 9 samples and consolidating those into those individual site samples. One of the outcomes of that was that we may have missed some of the peak values that would have occurred by compositing those samples, but we also may have provided more representation of a wider area for that area. So some of the drawbacks, the plus and minuses of changing and doing anything in a monitoring program. 2009 continued. We changed some of the signs language on the green for readability. Actually, just changed the background. But we changed this yellow map from that caution, as you remember, to this full kind of outlay of what goes on, the data. And it shows, this is a picture of the lake, and it has all the sampling numbers, and you can't see that really well at home, but all these things are on our website. And then it actually had the value, and that's what this green area shows here, is the actual values at each site. And then if it reached a level that was above the threshold, we posted this health advisory sign on the sand at the high-risk swimming area, so right at Regatta Grounds, per se. We also added this banner to the NewsGuard publication that they graciously provide for us. Our water quality monitoring is provided there in the NewsGuard, and then they added this like banner down here for the CynoWatch program. So that was new. 2010, third year toxins, fourth year cell counts. We added an integrated photic zone, a mid-lake sample, and we changed the signage slightly. We're no longer posting right on the beaches. We were just going to using the kiosks. And the Department of Health and Human Services really got their harmful algal bloom surveillance program off the ground, as far as I can tell, during that year, from a website perspective. And that HABS, the surveillance program, was really kind of being kind of branded at that point. So no change on the green sign. The yellow sign, we modified slightly, added this stoplight kind of information. It's had the same values would be shown here, cell count, density. And then we changed this messaging down here to just a permanent message that was used each week, and so we weren't having to create a new message that was, you know, it was just a consistent message. And then our red sign we changed significantly, too. We changed the title from health advisory to water contact advisory. And then we changed all this language in here to copy what Washington State had on their postings. Oregon didn't really have a good setup at that time to mimic, and we felt that this was the best. We changed our swimmer icon to a caution, prohibited, and we added this pet, no pet icon here, because that was really the biggest risk is to pets and small children at that point, if because the pets drink a lot of water, obviously. And we added Spanish to these bits here, so we had a partially bilingual sign. That's the same. The banner actually changed to just a standardized banner, so that was the change then too. 2011, fifth year cell counts, fourth year toxin testing. Permanent signs, we created some permanent signs in the watershed. Department of Health and Human Services became the Oregon Health Authority, as indicated by their change of website here. Their HABS program added some changes. They're requiring now antitoxin A, which is a different toxin, as well as the microcystin, to be tested if you have those type of the cyanobacteria that will produce that toxin. And this little thing, which is hardly visible, is actually the chemical representation of antitoxin, just for those interested. It's in black. It's hard to see. I'm sorry about that. But. So 011 here, CynoWatch green sheet here, the contact, we just kind of modified this a little bit to add frequently asked questions, just to make it more user-friendly to look at, change some of the, added these images, added that dog image. The yellow and the red were unchanged. And so that's where we were last, basically August, finishing it up. And so for 2012, we're potentially looking at changing some of the language again now. And this is where it gets tricky. I think the idea is to change it to get in line with what the state says. Well, I've got a few slides that show what the state's showing, and we'll go through those briefly. But the other thing we might want to do is just change it from a CynoWatch program to a harmful algal bloom surveillance program. That in itself would be a mimic the state, which
point of alignment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think that would, I don't think we're married to CynoWatch. It's just what we branded it as. I think we can make that switch pretty simply. a little bit of confusion, obviously, when you change anything. But then, yeah, so some language edits. We'd have to change our website, the displays, some brochures, and potentially put up some permanent signs. I got this email from Bonnie Weidberg from the Public Health Educator Harmful Algal Bloom Surveillance Program. And I'll just read it. They call it Harmful Algal Blooms because that's what their grant was titled. So, I mean, it makes sense to, they'll be sticking with it, assumingly. For materials they develop for the public, they use both the terms blue-green algae and cyanobacteria, and they're gradually moving towards the terminology cyanobacteria, also called blue-green algae. So we're kind of in line with that already. You know, that's kind of where we've been. So, you know, to follow with where they're going, and as you'll see on these slides, it would make sense to just keep with those things. Now, these are some permanent signs that they developed last year. And if you're familiar with the beach water quality monitoring program where they have the flip signs down at the D River wayside or any number of different saltwater beaches, they're doing testing for bacteria. And they have these signs which, if you fold it up, which is the way it looks on the left, it says water monitoring. It just lets people know that we monitor the water here. And then when you flip it down, and there's like a padlock that keeps it in place, it says it gives you this health advisory, avoid water contact. And so the language here that it's got here, it says water monitoring on the left here. This lake or river is monitored for cyanobacteria, also called blue-green algae, which produces toxins that may make you sick. When in doubt, stay out. Don't go in the water when it's foamy, scummy, thick like paint, pea green, blue green, or brownish red. More information, blah, da, 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 da. Okay? And then if we have an event and we're posting, then we drop the sign down, open it up, and then it would say health advisory. Here's the no swimming icon. Avoid water contact. Do not use this water for drinking or cooking. It says harmful cyanobacteria, and then parentheses blue green algae levels. Activities that don't involve water contact, like canoeing, hiking, and camping, are encouraged. And that's part of their messaging, too. They don't want to scare people away from the water area, for sure. They don't want to, you know, make you think you can't go into the park. And that if you're not splashing about and swimming, you know, you're not really putting yourself at risk either.
So I guess the thing that I'm not getting out of this, Paul, is when do they, or A, are they playing up?
Yes. Mining? Yeah, they can provide, and I don't know if we can get six of them, but I know we can get a few of them. They said a few, and so, I mean, we could push for one. I mean, it would make sense to have it consistent all around, but if we only got two or three, then, say, Regatta Grounds and East Devils Lake State Park, you know, would make sense.
These would post up on our kiosks.
Yeah, yeah.
Question then, you know, obviously if they're doing this new signage, When does the sign open up? Does the sign open up at yellow? Does it open up at red?
I think it opens at red for this. Red. Yeah, because this one would go, if we were to, yeah, it would go at red. So at yellow, in fact, this sign, it's kind of hard to see, but the trim of this one on the left is kind of yellow. Right here, this bar right here. It looks kind of green on the screen there. But it's kind of yellow. And then this one is definitely a red down here, the trim. Okay. So, so this one is just like, in the left, it's like, we're monitoring. This area is monitored, FYI. But if you see something that looks, you know, wrong, you know, don't trust the monitoring just because it's not posted. You know, use your best judgment.
Now, I also saw, if you could flip back to the 12 slide.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was the one before this. There was a slide that said something about outside
outside lab.
Required. Does that mean that we can no longer do our own testing if we're going to be part of that?
I only put that in there because of this toxin, this additional toxin.
Oh, the anatoxin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So our microcystin monitoring is purely fine. Yeah. It's just that when we, if we get to a situation where we get a anatoxin producer and the cell counts are above the threshold, so then we post. And then to unpost, we have to add this other level of toxicity monitoring. So that's really where it comes in. It's just a change that, you know, we'll still use our microcystin monitoring, absolutely.
Yeah, just to be clear, we have not seen antitoxin A in our lake as of yet.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you, I haven't seen the deck, but hopefully you're going to walk through the results of the program over the year to talk about when we have and haven't had.
Well, you know, I don't have all that right here. I'm more just looking at the because the languaging, the messaging, because that's kind of really what we're looking at tonight. You know, off the top of my head, we had in 2009, we had a pretty bad summer. I think from a water quality perspective, I'm getting a nod over there. So, yeah, and then 2010 was pretty good, and 2011 was pretty decent, too. We did have a bloom of just in the winter, though, you know. So, I mean, the stuff's out there. It's just, you know, the sun is always that biggest driver. You know, I mean, we had cool temperature this winter, and we had a bloom that accumulated in certain areas, you know, as many of you may have seen. But in the summertime, that window last year was pretty good. So that was the permanent signs that we can get.
Would those take the place of your red, yellow, and...
This would, you know, what I would imagine, this would take place of... the red. And the yellow one, if we want to use, would be either, maybe we could just use that on the website too. You know, we don't necessarily have to provide all the information to everyone all the time. You know, all that graph, the map.
Right.
But that was, at the time it seemed like that's what we wanted to do, because it would provide as much information as you can so that you could show that, well, and I guess the reason for doing that is you might have one of these signs here, which, you know, was flipped down, or our old red sign, you know, there. And you don't necessarily know that the rest of the lake, how the rest of the lake is doing. And so in our this is a lesson we learned from the bacteria monitoring program from the E. coli. We had really horrible results at Regatta Grounds in 05, I think it was, 05, 06, before we got rid of those geese. Now, the rest of the lake was fine. So if you just went to Regatta Grounds, you would have just saw this thing and that's the lake's horrible, you know. But that wasn't the complete story. It was like, this area is bad. And so that, I think, is the benefit of having all of the data out. Now, cyanobacteria are fickle, you know. I mean, they blow around you know, you don't necessarily... until you have a lake-wide bloom, those levels probably are going to be quite different. Although we have had times where the center of the lake was actually had just as much, if not more, microcystin, the toxin, than parts of the near shore where you would have expected it, where it was accumulating. So that dynamic plays out in the water, and that's why having as much data as possible. So, you know, again, to answer your question, I would see this replacing the red. We could keep the green informational signs up and update them. We did just print up some new ones. You know, there's about $35 a piece. There isn't probably too much to change. We can change those to further be in line. But it seems like we're pretty close to being in line with certainly the direction they're going. Because our signs say cyanobacteria, a.k.a. blue-green algae. That's the language that we're using on the green signs. So the yellow ones are easy to change because that's paper, you know. And then this would replace the red signs if they were needed. That's when that would flip down and be out there. This is their yellow sign, effectively. Or no, this would be their red sign, if you will. This is what they use as a template. And it says, and see, this is where, you know, like I said in the email, they're transitioning their messaging to cyanobacteria, a.k.a. blue-green algae. So in this template, which I think was produced just last year because it's got their new logo, it says, due to high levels of blue-green algae, that can produce harmful toxins. And it's got, it says, health advisory. So, you know, there's you know, current signage change, you know, there's slight variation, I guess, in where they're at and where they're going and where they're at.
So do they plan on publishing signage this year?
I asked them that, and they said no. That they weren't going to be changing. In fact, that was part of this...
Our signage?
What's that?
We shared our signage with...
Yeah. And there's actually in March, there's actually a stakeholder meeting, which I plan on attending in Portland, for this whole HAB surveillance program to just really stay up to speed as to what DEQ and their other, well, OHA and the other partners such as DEQ are working on. But yeah, they say that they're, the other part of this email said that they're, you know, have no intent in changing the language per se. But they're moving towards, so if they do make a change, it's going to say cyanobacteria, also called blue-green algae, apparently. I just have AKA.
Blue-green algae, also known as cyanobacteria, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and or you could say blue-green algae, scientifically known as cyanobacteria, you know, something like that.
And something like, you know, from a stakeholder perspective, if they want to, you know, I would look at it, you know, and say, if they really feel the need to have the scientific name out there,
mm-hmm.
I think the common name is better first,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's what I, as a person, would go, blue-green algae, I can look and mm-hmm. know that I can, you mm-hmm. know, I can equate that to what's mm-hmm. going on in water body that mm-hmm. I'm seeing, and then I can go, okay,
mm-hmm.
Paul would call it cyanobacteria.
Right, and I think that makes total sense. So, you know, as we look at morphing this, I think it would make sense to just go to blue-green algae or harmful algal blooms. I mean, that's the other thing. There's that other level, but I think blue-green algae and then, you know, a.k.a. cyanobacteria or just technically known as cyanobacteria, you know. And that just helps qualify it. It provides, you know, the blue-green algae, which isn't like you say, it has that kind of instant recognition, I think, for more folks. And I think, and we've talked about this in the past, the key to moving away from just calling it algae is from, you know, from a scientific perspective and from a human health aspect, is to get people to think of it other than just algae, which most of us think algae, oh, it's great, it's part of the food chain. But the blue-green algae, which are really technically cyanobacteria, aren't part of that same food chain, and so that's that they produce toxins, and so they're totally different animals, no pun intended.
So you know, I think that would be like I think kind of where we've come, at least in the past, mm-hmm. is that, you know, that common association capability is more important than the scientific name when it comes mm-hmm. to people interacting with the advisories that, or you know, just the information mm-hmm. out there.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is common name first, right? If it's blue-green algae that you want to, you know, recognize, I can look at, you know, I can go blue-green algae and I can go, okay, so do I see something that looks like algae to me mm-hmm. in the water that the advisory is posted mm-hmm. at, right? Mm-hmm. And then I can go, okay, it is also known as cyanobacteria,
yeah.
And then, you know, then you start building that, right?
I don't know that
the general population, you know, I mean, I wouldn't know what cyanobacteria was if I wasn't part of the board.
I think that's a fair assessment, and, you know, I think bacteria sounds invisible, you know, because a lot of bacteria are, certainly to the naked eye, and many cyanobacteria are to the naked eye as well, but a lot of them aren't, you know. Like when we're talking about the Glowotrichia that dominates the lake in the summertime, you know, that's obviously visible. So when you think of putting that algae word out there with it, it does, I think, make the person think, oh, it's algae. I know I can see algae, and so you can look for it, and that's a good thing, because you do want to. You don't want them just to think, oh, it could just be invisible. You know what I mean? And I think that it makes sense to, you know, from a messaging perspective.
So I would have this question for you. I know that you're potentially looking at signage changes, and, you know, changing the language and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and I would think that. If we feel that waiting until we have the chance to, you know, meet with Oregon Health, you know, as a stakeholder in this mm-hmm. program in March, if that gives us the ability to be nimble enough to make the changes to mm-hmm. our program for the summer,
we can do that.
Then I'm fine with waiting until we do that, and going and using the time in between now and then to kind of prepare our point of view mm-hmm. that we want to share with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that meeting before or after our monthly meeting?
It's probably
after.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think it said like March 12th or something.
I think it was March 7th.
Okay.
So that would be.
It could be right.
Could
there.
Be right on the day too. Yeah, there. It may be. Actually, I think it's Wednesday.
No, it's like March 1st.
Is our meeting is March 1st Thursday?
I'm thinking that's right.
I think you're right.
I'm
too.
Not sure.
Okay, so it'll be after our March meeting, yeah.
So if we can prepare our point of view prior to, you know, for our March meeting, so that, you know, we can understand where what we want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
That I think that's important that the board has a kind of a...
Yeah, and basically outlining that...
Agreed upon point of view on where we're going with that.
You know, this blue-green algae, technically known as, scientifically known as, whatever, as the lead... You know, for this type of messaging.
Yeah, and there may be other aspects that you know you want to present to us over the next month or over the next couple of months, so that we mm-hmm. can, you know, have a complete picture of where we want to go with our input into this partnership
right.
with them.
So. Right.
Could you send this slide group mm-hmm. to us?
Sure. Yeah.
Everybody got a color printer?
I don't.
Well, could you print a couple out?
Too, yeah.
So that because I mean it's really helpful just to be able to sit there and look at them sequentially one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
When I can't compare them, it's harder.
Yeah, sure. I can send out. I can mail you all paper copies if you want.
I just electronic copies on it.
Electronic works for you. And if you've got printers and electronic copies, okay, yeah. I'll send it as the full slides and as like a 6-sheet. Generally, when I do a PowerPoint slideshow, you can put them like 6 per page, and it's pretty visible too. And
yeah, but I think with some of the wording, I like to
see the full,
especially those new signs. It was blurry to me.
Yeah, and it is. And I just did a grab and a picture grab. Kind of just in closing here. This is a sample news release that they would have sent out last August. It looks like for some county in Coos County, and they use the language here, a health advisory prompted by high algae levels. So even in here, you can see they really haven't cemented it too well, in my opinion. You know, they haven't really cemented the consistency. Why not just say cyanobacteria, a.k.a. blue-green algae? They say prompted by high algae levels. You know, so there's some work, I think, that may go on at the March meeting. They don't have any intent of changing anything drastically, though. They did provide that. And then it says water monitoring has confirmed the presence of blue-green algae, so they use that in this one. And I don't believe in this news release they use the word cyanobacteria.
Yeah.
And I don't have the full copy of it here, but when I remember skimming it, I don't believe they used it in that. But then again, it's showing you... You know,
yeah,
where they are and where they may be going.
This is very different than what we've put out in the past.
Well, actually, this is only a fragment of it.
Yeah.
This is a two or three page media release, and it's pretty lengthy.
It
talks about like the hazards and la da da. I mean, it's way too long to show it on this screen. But anybody can see it. This sample one here. This is or any number of them. They just go to their website and click on the current. Listings and and so this is just the top 5% of the
I know that we changed some of the language towards the end of the season last year when we were worried about seeing some evidence of bloom so
just kind of maybe we'll be changing this CyanoWatch to harmful algal bloom surveillance. You know, this might be a change for the green sheet. Blue-green algae, a.k.a. cyanobacteria. Algal toxins versus cyanotoxins might be a change here. You know, this is kind of what I see on our green sheet.
Can you? Would it be something that we could do over the next month or so to kind of just mock those changes up in electronic copy for us?
Sure.
So that look at it and then maybe... use that as kind of building the initial steps and building our point of view for March.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that you, if the other board members agree, that you put it on the agenda for February.
Okay.
And just with the, some indication that, you know, this will be up for decision as to what our recommendation will be to DHS, or the Oregon Health Authority, excuse me.
Right now, yeah.
In after the, at the March meeting, and maybe with the mock-ups that, that David is suggesting at the February meeting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that over the course of the month, if you want to send it out to the board or, you know, maybe work with Director Weldon, seeing how he's not here to
sign him a duty.
he could take up that,
committee's,
you know, that,
kind create
of that draft first look before it gets to the meeting.
Okay, and then so, yeah, this is just the other kind of sample stuff that we might look at. So, and then other things that would change would be our display. There's some language on this display that would have to change, some brochures we'd want to update. Website would need a overhaul for sure, which is time intensive, you know. And
well, and I wouldn't expect that we would change all the historical documents.
Right, right. I see, yeah.
I wouldn't see us changing those historical documents because they are a public record.
Yeah, it would be but just like a website
change is what I would be.
Yeah. But having, you know, new, you know, like if we have this, this is a little icon of this Protect Your Pets, which is on our website, you know, if you go to the website, you get to see a big copy of this thing. You know, it would make sense that if we're going to change it, for the other stuff to update those as well, you know, just and then it gets we would just replace that and just, but those things just take time, you know. And that was, you know, the original goal of this was to assess how much time it would take to make these changes. And you know, I'm estimating, you know, it's going to take 56 hours, and that's a rough estimate, and that's with everything, all this stuff. Hopefully less, but some of the work is already kind of included in that 56 because I had to get some to get there. But so here, this is just the last slide I think I have, just the next steps, which I think we have direction from you, attending the stakeholder meeting, and then, you know, if we want to look at installing those flip signs, those ones that they can install, those permanent ones, get some signs revised, which these are just offerings that I would suggest at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I
heard from you, I think.
I don't know that I have anything like, negative to say about the signs, but I think as long as what we do is consistent through the watershed, right? I think, to me, that's the key. I think if we have, if they only have three signs that we can get, and we have seven shoreline sampling sites, take the three signs we have this year and wait till another three
next
year.
Yeah, right? No, that's
so that
not
we
a bad idea.
Have that consistency.
Yeah.
I don't want. I think when you have a program going on, like it's consistency, so people know what's going. You know. Doesn't look different from here to there.
No, I agree.
Well, yeah, I mean, consistent throughout the watershed, but also clearly that it's site specific.
Yeah, right. To have those yellow, the yellow signage that has that data set that shows, you know, it does help, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that
it might be that
wider picture.
The data set can change a little bit, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know that the parts per billion is something that adds a whole lot of value, but maybe we look at, you know, the site specific color coding and make it more of a map.
Yeah, it's hard, you know.
It's hard to say, you know. It could be that, you know, what information is valuable, you know, in, you know, on site at the location versus, you know, the in depth,
right,
and backup that we would have, you know, posted to the website, right.
Yeah,
and support what we're.
You know, you're absolutely right, and you know, part of that, the reasoning for putting all that information out there was, just, you know, what if it's 9 parts per billion, and we're posting, and someone's like, well, it's not 50. That's my threshold. You know, that's like, you know, and that's what we were hearing from people. It was like, I go out and tell it's, you know, whatever. Right. And so that was kind of a way of saying, okay, it's 6 here, it's 7 here, it's 8 there. Okay, 8 actually is officially a posting. Okay, you know, here it is. But it's not 50.
Yeah.
Or when it is 50 or 150, you know, it would show that too. So it kind of,
you know, it could be, you know, a concept that works well as a sliding scale to where people can see, you know, the sliding scale and go, okay, are we moving from yellow to green and how close are we? Right.
Yeah.
Like that, you know?
Yeah. I'm all about like having it, you know, work. you know, that's really the tool, you know, to have it work. I mean,
I'm glad that we've done a lot of the changes over the years. I think we've improved year over year in general. I think, you know, there's always room for improvement when we're working on these kind of programs. So thank you.
Thank you.
So what do we got next? Looks like the conference, NOMS. Do you want to give an update from your conference attendance, Paul?
So, you know, I don't really think it, I don't know how much value it is to regurgitate all this stuff for you.
Very little.
but it's, these are just some quick summaries of some of the talks that I went to at the North American Lake Management Society meeting in Spokane, and then also the Oregon Lake Association meeting in Portland that Seth actually went to, too, this last year. So if there's things that strike your that you're curious about, please let me know, and I can provide you or other people in the district too, speaking out to the general public, some of those contacts. You know, if they want to talk to, you know, Philip or Nancy or, you know, these names here that are in here about these specific things, I can provide you a little information and certainly their contact details too.
Okay, so
I would just point out just the one thing from at the Oregon Lake Association meeting that I think will interest a lot of people is this Atlas of Oregon Lakes that's online. It's pretty cool. Just there's a link here. It's aol.research.pdx.edu, not America Online, but Atlas of Oregon Lakes, which actually you can click on Devil's Lake or any other number of lakes. And it's actually, they're going to try to make this a data center for all the information about lakes that DEQ would also hold on a lake. And they do, what's that?
So is this something that we can, you know, link out to on our website?
Yeah, yeah, and I think we should do. You know, one thing that they have on there is a SECI transparency comparison between, say, Devil's Lake and all Oregon lakes. That I put that on our on the staff report just as because that's the one metric that they have online for most of these lakes right now.
So, can you explain that to everybody?
Sure. so this a SECI depth is how clear the lake is, and you use this disc that drops down through the lake, and is where it disappears is what's known as a SECI depth, and it's universally used for lakes and the ocean too. Oceanographers use something very similar to this, and it's, I mean, you could build one at home. You know, it's a paper plate with black markings on it, effectively that sinks, and it's really a good gauge as to water clarity. And so you can take SECI depths throughout the year and determine, you know, in at least a broad strokes, where you're sitting at, you know, relative to any other number of water bodies. And frankly, we've got a ways to improve. You know, we're a shallow lake. Obviously, there's some impacts there that are coastal lakes, which tend to not have as great as clarity as, say, you know, you're getting compared to Crater Lake in this database too, you know, and all sorts of cascade high alpine lakes, which don't have the nutrient structure. But it's a good indicator, and it's something that we monitor. So it's like, you know, it's simple too. It's just simple. You're just looking out, looking at the water, seeing how far you can see to the, hopefully to the bottom.
So is this in meters?
These are in meters. Yeah, they would be in meters. It doesn't show it on there, but it would have to be. Yeah.
Or yards or whatever.
Effectively a yard. Yeah, it's, you know. Yeah, so we're like, you know, 1 to 2 meters is from this data set. You know, there's certain times of the year, and, you know, this where they get all this data, I'm not confident where it's all coming. It's what DEQ, they have on DEQ, effectively, is where they got it. So it's going to reflect the data that DEQ has.
Is that
which
data
would be,
that we provide, though?
Well, we have been. We have done, yeah. And whether or not they've updated that, my guess is they haven't. I've heard that, you know, with the staff reductions that they've had for their volunteer monitoring programs, it's not, you know, necessarily getting to the database.
Yeah, so I guess I would look at this and say if we're 2.5 to maybe a little bit more or less, then that's 2/3 of the way to the average depth of the lake. You can see the bottom. So that's not.
Yeah, so like our maximum depth here would be about 7 meters. So we're not going to ever.
Right.
You know, you're never going to be comparing it completely to all lakes.
Yeah.
But if you could be 7 meters, that would be great. You know, I mean, that would be, and at times you know, you're close. You know, I think our best clarity is probably about 4.5 meters. You know, that's pretty staple. You know, in the summertime, it gets down to 0.5 meter. You know, I mean, you know, 1 meter for sure, depending on where you're at. Generally, these are done in the Broad Lake, so they kind of try to, you know, get. I mean, there's a lot of lakes out there, and you don't have a lot of time, so you're going to try to simplify it and say, okay, let's do one sample in the middle of a lake. And that's a general practice. You know, we've got, you know, more resources than that. We go out and look at it more closely than that. But I think some of the data that would be on that Oregon Lakes website would probably be, you know, pretty simple. Broad brush kind of stuff, yeah. But pretty interesting. I have.
Thank you. Any? Okay, digital camera.
So just like our current camera that we have now, I think it's like 5 or 6 years old. It's just showing the signs of aging. It like shuts off randomly. It doesn't read the battery all the time. The USB drive to like upload your photos doesn't really work anymore. And we kind of knew this was coming. It's been a while. So in this last budget, we budgeted $500 for replacement. And I think now would probably be a good time to do that. So I just looked online and for a few different cameras, basically, you know, looking for something that's waterproof and durable outside because our camera gets a little beat up sometimes. So there's 3 cameras there for your review. There's some little like specifications on the left that kind of tells you a little bit about them and the costs. And basically, after like looking through some reviews for them, they all seem to be fine. And I just selected the cheapest one on here. It's the Panasonic Lumix to add. You know, case, the memory card. It's generally nice for us to get a reusable, like an extra battery, so we can have them both charged up. The total cost on December 27th for that would have been $316 plus shipping. So if you guys are okay with us getting a new camera, I don't know. What's the best way for us to make, I mean, as far as the cost goes on that, because we're not 100% sure what it's going to be.
Well, if they wanted to approve up to like what's budgeted, I mean, we put $500 in the budget.
Yeah.
We've looked at 3 types of different cameras and at different varying prices. And I mean, if it was, you know, if it was me, I would just say, you know, up to what was budgeted, if that's amicable with the board.
Okay. So, I'll make a motion that we. Approve up to the budgeted amount for, it's assuming it'll come in less, for the purchase of a new digital camera for the use of the district.
Second.
Any discussion? Yep.
Good. I probably need some new board member photos. We'll have to test it out. So if you guys can all come in, we'll update that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Non-agenda items.
Well, I have something. Just noting that I guess it was close to 2 weeks ago that I noticed a boat parked at one of my docks, and it turned out to be the fellow, part of that crew that's putting in the water takeout for the Indian land across from Blue Heron. And they're not quite finished. I'm not sure exactly what it entails, but they did all the water work, the work in the lake. And he said it was, Levy said it was down somewhere between 5 and 7 feet in depth. I think it was 5.7, that was it. And so it doesn't sound like it'll ever be a problem as far as depth goes and interference by boats. We get a lot, as you know, a lot of skiing in that area. And it's well below anything you could possibly hit. So they said it worked out very well as far as the placement goes.
That's great. That's good news. I actually did, you know, visit the site when they were doing the drilling, and it's pretty impressive. I think I posted things on our Facebook pages. They were doing it. But, yeah, I mean, they stirred up more just getting the boat over there to monitor it than they did with the drilling stuff, you know, because it gets so muddy and shallow over there. You know, it's like just the prop, you know, of a, you know, when you trying to service an area over there, you know, when they got all the way to the near shore was way more turbidity than would have been caused by this drill that came all the way from the shore under the lake. And they also shot it all the way underneath the highway and onto like this second fairway over there at the golf course. So they did an L. They shot it to the lake, and then they have their tee, their box there, and then they're shooting it across the lake, and it hooks up then to the you know, the pump system over there.
We know when they're going to start exercising that?
I don't. I assume they would, I mean, get it done for this summer, though. I mean, I have to imagine, you know, but I don't know the time frame on that.
You know, because I think I recall back to some of our, and you know, conversations around that. We were really interested to see what their, you know, change in fertilizer plans were going to be based on the, you know, the lack of chlorine in the water.
Yep.
For washing away, you know, so...
Yeah,
it'd be nice to kind of keep on top of that.
Yeah, we can certainly ask to, you know, get as much information that they can provide to us relative to the changes. I mean, that was obviously the reason we supported it, was to aid in the reduction of nutrients in the watershed, and in fact, the extraction of nutrients from the basin, from the lake. You know, which is, you know, what they're effectively doing by using that nutrient-rich water on the golf course. As compared to using chlorinated water, which you'd have to add a lot of fertilizer to.
Yeah. So I think it would be good for, you know,
follow up on,
or something to follow up on, and make sure that we have some, hopefully some good wind statements for reducing nutrient loads in the watershed by that action. Any other non-agenda items? Additional public comment.
Yes, you need to state your name and address.
Speak to the mic. State your name.
My name is Matt Christie. I live on Southeast 3rd Street along the canal that goes under the 2nd Street Bridge. And so my concern is that the end of the canal has become plugged up, and we have no flow through the canal anymore whatsoever, except for when we get these big rainstorms like we had 2 weeks ago. And... effectively, what that's doing with no flow through there is the annual growth dies off and makes the canal shallower and shallower every year. And in an effort to maintain what depth we have now, I was wondering if there's any talk amongst the district of removing the sand buildup at the end of the canal and the area just behind the dam there to hopefully increase flow.
I can speak to that briefly. You know, we did do a project last, was it April?
Somewhere
around there to move some logs out of the, from that little bridge that's on First Street there, to facilitate sand removal hydraulically by its own pressure, because we didn't really have the permits or anything else to remove any sand, even if we just moved it.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to get permission to move the logs, which You know, the hope was is that that it would help facilitate some of that flow through there, which, you know, there isn't a big watershed behind there. You know, I mean, a lot of that canal is just, I mean, it's going to be sluggish. It's not going to have a big rain event. It's really not necessarily going to push a lot of flow through there, but it does flow. You know, we do know it flows through there because, you know, when you can see some current in there, obviously. And hopefully through the winter it'll help. It'll scar it out, scavenge it out a little bit more. But that's where we sat from last year. We didn't have any plans of doing any dredging, though.
Yeah, I guess my understanding is dredging's out of the question as far as the canal itself, but the buildup of sand there at the end of the lake, is that because it's, you know, sediment brought in by the ocean, does that fall under a different...
No.
No? Unfortunately,
yeah,
not.
Yeah, the challenge is it replaces itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way the structure's there, at a minimum, the structure, the dam base, the base of the dam is going to stop. It's going to go past it and drop.
Settle. Yeah.
Settle, right? Yes. And, you know, with the, you know, the height wave events, I mean, you can see up to the canal, you know, seafoam coming in on big events.
Right?
And every time you see that, sand is getting deposited there, right? And so, I mean, it's a difficult thing to, you know, do you maintain something that nature is going to replace anyway? Continually, right? Is it worth, you know, the cost of doing that? I don't know that it would increase the flow in the canal because you're neck down to, what, 3 feet
maybe
underneath that bridge, right? So I don't know that even taking that out would increase a lot of flow through that zone. I mean, is it open today? I haven't been down there.
I doubt it because I went through last weekend with the high water level from all the rain, and that was the first time I've been able to go through, and I'm going to say since probably April. And like even with the state park, I know the state park does kayak trips, and they used to come through there last year, but we don't see them anymore because it's just not open.
Yeah, and that was, you know, one of the reasons that we went in and pulled those logs is to provide at least in a higher water event an access through there because it was pretty well choked off entirely by the logs. I mean, it was, you could maybe dance through there if you were nimble, but I don't think they would want to have taken inexperienced kayakers through there. But hopefully, you know, if some of the sand kind of shifts around a little bit, that there'll be at least some, you know, navigable water through there, because I mean that was the goal, and but we also realized the shortcomings of the limits of what we were doing. You know, we weren't dredging. We did recognize there was a lot of sand there, and you know, there's going to be sand deposited there. I mean, it's the seas really just control it. You know, it can be the next day. You know, as we see with the Dee River, we'll dredge it one morning, and then if it's next storm, we'll fill that whole thing in too, and the same things at play up just on the east side of the bridge too. So
okay, I was like, there's not a whole lot we can do about it then.
Yeah, and you know, like, you know, potentially you could get homeowners together. I guess would be something you could talk about and look at. A small local improvement district relative to maintaining that canal. I mean, these are just kind of ideas to throw out there. You know, you'd still have to get the same permits that anyone else would have to, and, you know, there's regulations, but, you know, that's at least potentially feasible, I'd say.
Okay.
You know, and...
you guys be a good resource for that as far as knowing who to talk to as far as permits go?
We could surely absolutely point you in the right direction. Yeah.
I think one of the things that we learned last year when the state came through and did the land survey is that, you know, looking at docks and boathouses and all of that and riprap and such, that they don't even consider the canals part of the domain that they check. Right, so when they got to the end of the canal, right, they don't consider that state property because they don't go back at, you know, no one in the canals was inventoried docks, boathouses, and seawalls and all that like the rest of the shoreline was. So I think there's other opportunities that, you know, make themselves available when you have land ownership outside of the state, right, to maintain those kind of areas.
Okay.
So
that's good input.
Yeah, so Paul can definitely help point you in the right direction for things that you might want to do.
Okay.
You know.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. And, you know, we'll review it and be supportive if we can, for
okay.
sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, you guys are looking into that property right there as well, and that's definitely affected by that, all the sand buildup along the dock there.
Yeah.
Well, it's, anyway.
Thanks for your comment and time.
And prolonging this just a little, are we ever likely to ask that those logs, we be allowed to take those logs out? I mean, I can see where in an event they could become a real problem if they all piled up right there.
Yeah.
And do they do any good? I understand that they're supposed to be habitat for salmon, but
well, what they do serve from a habitat perspective is twofold. And as a fish is coming upstream, it's just made it past the seals, which is what they're fighting in the stream, which is where it's running, you know, the Dee River by Kylos. Once they get into the lake, they're going to look for a breather, you know. They're going to look for a, you know, a pause. And that's where that habitat plays a role for the upward migration of coho. Downstream, the same thing is true. I mean, like, if you have coho going out the river, they're going to get nearer and nearer and nearer the throat of the Dee River, and where it gets really shallow all of a sudden, and they're going to want to be prepped and ready to go. So they're going to hang out underneath a log where it's a little deeper. It tends to, you know, get a little deeper around logs, just the way the water interacts. And so there's little hiding pockets and such. And then the other aspect that Fish and Wildlife will say is it's a wildlife perspective too. So there's, you know, some bird and other you know, habitat that's associated with logs in the streams or outside of the streams. As to the question, you know, we were able to move those logs without a permit because they were basically floatable. They weren't lodged in into the sediment, which would be true too. We could remove those logs. But we couldn't have removed them at the window of time that we had. And so what that means is, like, to do work on the lake at the time, we would have had to have done it between
October and February.
Yeah, like November and February, I think it is, right? And that, you know, that was April, and we wanted to do it. So what we were allowed to do is to get a variance to the time of frame that we're supposed to work in the lake to allow us to do it in April or whatever, but with the restriction that we wouldn't take them out of the watershed. So, you know, to go back in there and to reinvest with the crane, et cetera, yeah, I suppose we could do. But we'd have to do it in the wintertime. You know,
so have those shifted at all on any of those?
I don't think so. Yeah, and I think they're going to be pretty stable. You know, I mean, obviously the real, and what we had Bill do was we had him pile up a few so that it would kind of help lock them down a little bit. That was ODF&W's suggestion. But I mean, if it's 3 feet of sea in there, which we've seen 3 foot waves roll through there, it's going to move something eventually. I mean, we're not going to fight the Pacific and win. You know, if that's the case. But they are, you know, I guess what would likely happen is they would just go further up and they'd go towards a state park and maybe in towards that that other little primitive boat launch, which would be a negative for sure. But
anything you want Paul to do, a follow up for subsequent meeting on that?
Anything, right?
Yeah. Any other non-gen items? Board comments?
Yeah. I just wanted to welcome David
And Mitchell Moore wrote that letter, and I read that. I sure hope everyone else did, but I agree with it completely. So.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I was going to mention that. We did get a nice complimentary letter. I think I brought a copy of it, but, you know, just really congratulating us on a great year. And lots of pluses. The database, the shoreline projects, Regatta Grounds, the East Devils Lake State Park rain garden, the lakescaping class, the strategic plan for grass carp, the RFP and the work with that we're going to be working with Joe Eilers now, communications he talks about and which we've been participating in a high level, skier down flags, the recreational brochure was new this year. Seth did a great job on that. Seed packets, you know, lots of great things. The kiosks, K Street. We got a new kiosk there. Sign and watch signs, he says. Local media, getting information out there through the local media. Channel 4, water quality monitoring, you know, log removal. He mentions a kayak navigation thing we were just talking about. Some progress on the cafe and internships. Lisa and now David.
Yeah, so I think that we established at our last meeting that when somebody sends in public comments, we'll go ahead and attach them. Attach them to the minutes. So.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah.
So they become record. So let's do that. Thanks for that, Kip. If nothing else, I'll adjourn the meeting.
Ooh. Good talk, buddy. Good.